8:20 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, with the winter season winding down, we figured it was time to get a perspective of how the season was for Main Street merchants in the studio. I've got the executive director of the Historic Park City Alliance, Michael Brill. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what are you hearing from merchants? I mean, certainly lackluster in terms of snow, but does that mean more people out eating and shopping?
It does sometimes. It was a weird winter, I think, both in terms of weather. We launched our new parking program, and Sundance continues to kind of evolve in terms of how it influences the Old Town District. So, I think it's not easily comparable to past winters, and we're trying to get our feel for what the shifting sands are and kind of what the new normal is. But yes, in some cases, bad weather, why you would think it would be a real issue. As long as it's not for prolonged stretches, it's a day or two mixed in between some good snow, can drive visitors to look for some alternatives, and we're usually at the top of the list for what they look to spend their time doing when they're not skiing.
Yeah, I mean, the few nights I was out and about on Main Street, I mean, it was packed.
Yep, yeah, it's been a decent winter for most stretches. I think the end's been a little light on bookings, and we hope that we see some good spring break crowds as we finish out the season here, but the numbers are a little down towards the end in terms of what we're seeing in pre-booking. So we're always hoping that we can continue to engage people and have a strong finish.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that parking program. I mean, how did it go? I mean, what are you getting in terms of feedback?
I think operationally, certainly it had some challenges, both with the vandalism, which we hope is kind of an initial piece that we're over the hurdle on now. And, I think the city's actively prosecuting some of those initial occurrences, which hopefully will be a deterrent. Obviously, when you start a week before the season, that makes it challenging for everyone to kind of understand exactly the dynamics of how do you use a ticket and what happens at the gate and when do I need to prepay versus paying at the gate and those kinds of things. But I think we've gotten over most of the learning curve, and in terms of its effect on customers visiting Main Street, I think it was either neutral or positive. I mean, we did see more parking available proximate to Main Street during our peak periods, which was kind of the goal of that dynamic pricing, and certainly some growing pains for employees that were asked to use alternate modes and park in alternate locations. But I think most of them have gotten used to that program and found ways that work for them. I think we probably still have some outlying times or outlying situations where people have kids or people have multiple jobs where we, need to find ways that it works for them. And we'll continue to work with Kenzie and her team to do that. I think that the most important thing from this first season of the parking is the data. And we haven't seen that yet. Kenzie's working with her team to compile it and break it down for us. And then we just talked in the last couple of weeks about restarting a steering committee for the parking program that will include a good representation of merchants and employees, as well as some of the city staff, so that we can review that data and see what it's telling us in terms of where pricing needs to be implemented, what the seasonal calendar ought to be for when we implement it, and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so when you're looking at that data, I mean, what is it? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I think it's what's happening with occupancy. And again, the idea is that we want to keep the garage fairly full, but we want to have it available for customers. And same with the on-street parking. And so if it was sitting empty for long periods during our peak season, we want to look at that and try to understand why, and is there something that we can do with pricing or with signage or information to make sure that we're utilizing it as well as we can. And then I think, the underlying issue that the city was trying to address, besides proximate parking for customers, which was our priority, is congestion. And there are other influences to congestion, and the use of Uber and Lyft, and how people are moving through towns now is changing, how and where our hotel shuttles park and where they circulate. All of those kinds of things are sort of layered into this issue, and something that we need to continue to be a partner with the city staff and try to find better solutions for.
Yeah, what were employees doing? I mean, were they carpooling and getting into the garage, or were they mostly taking home stays?
I think it was a combination of things. I think we saw more carpooling and good utilization of those lots in those locations. We saw fairly good utilization of home stake lot, especially during the highest peak periods. I think we saw people more people on transit that were able to do that based on where they live. I think people just sort of find the way that works best for them in their personal situation. But all of the things that we hoped would be opportunities were utilized. And I think as we move forward, hopefully we'll see even better utilization rates.
Yeah. And how hard is it now for Main Street business owners to get employees? Are they shying away?
It is. It's hard. And it's something that I think I in particular need to kind of keep my ear to the ground on and be making sure that council understands those challenges and how some of the choices that we make with transportation and parking influence them. Housing is another, you know, influence. And so, we're not a community where most of our hourly employees can afford to live in the community. And so they are commuting in, and how they arrive and what their transportation is a big influence on their time, their availability, the costs to have a job here versus have a job somewhere else. And so the more pressures we put on that, the harder it becomes to attract people to work here versus somewhere else. And hopefully tip structure at restaurants and those kinds of things helps, but for our other businesses, it's increasingly a challenge.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Sundance. How did that go then for merchants?
Sundance was interesting. I think we had a lot of changes both in the operational plan for Sundance, where some of the venues that traditionally would have been on the street or in buildings on the street moved to other locations. We saw a little more activity in the outlying areas. And so a little less pressure in our view on the downtown district because of those changes. We also saw some increased licensing fees and some changes to load in, load out that we thought worked pretty well. Provided a little better balance to some of our trash costs and recycling that we see during Sundance, and a little less of that appearance of everyone's leaving in the middle of the week from the load out activity. On the other hand, we also felt like there was a discouragement from a flat rate parking at a fairly high rate per day that continued all the way through the festival. And so the second half of the festival, when we typically see locals bringing their visitors that are in town to ski or to see a couple of films, or we see a little bit more of that casual film goer and they're willing to come have lunch between films or take a day off and spend a little time downtown, we just didn't see that activity. And so revenues, by most reports from our membership, were down, particularly the second half of the festival. And that's a trend that they've seen for a couple of years. So that's an ongoing discussion item that we're having with the city, and in fact making part of our presentation for the Sundance debrief at council this week to try to look at whether we can kind of look at those dynamics, just like we talk about dynamic parking, and treat the second half of the festival a little different than the first, and maybe return access to Old Town a little bit more to what we would see normally, have an hourly rate so that even if it's elevated over what it would be the rest of the year, people can make a choice and say, oh, that's not so bad for an hour. I'll go down and have lunch, or I'll go down and run an errand, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. So you will get some say-so then when the council...
We'll have some input. Whether it translates into say-so or not, I don't know. But we're going to make our voice heard.
Yeah. And I know that you're already a little bit concerned about 2019, given that we've got Sundance happening and on the second weekend, the World Freestyle Championship. So... big.
It is going to be a big winner. Again, though, we think the second half of Sundance and a World Cup championship or ski race feels like business as usual to a ski town that's used to having lots of visitors, and particularly in the last couple of years with the changes to Vail Passes and the dynamics we see there. So again, I think our position will be, hey, that's a great opportunity for us to showcase our historic district, to showcase our authenticity, to showcase our local businesses. And so let's make sure that the circulation controls, the parking controls that we put in place are appropriate for that period, but that we don't treat the whole 3 weeks, like the 4 days that we start with at the beginning of the Sundance, that there are some differences there, and that we want to showcase those areas and invite people to come experience what we have to offer.
So those discussions will help happen later on?
Correct. Yeah, as we go into implementation planning. But again, we're trying to get that message out early and consistently, and then work through the specifics with the staff.
Okay. And with the purchase of Treasure Hill, the Park City Council has told us that the planned Brew Pub Plaza, now a thing of the past. The plan I've heard is maybe to sell the property as a way to kind of offset the cost of the bond. And I'm guessing that's not what your organization wanted to hear.
Yeah, it was a disappointment to hear that funding might be pulled, for sure. I think we're still hopeful that we're going to see some improvement to that area that helps attract people to the top of Main Street, and maybe not two decks and the kinds of sort of technical, structural, hydrogeological kinds of pieces that would have needed to be part of the ultimate plan that we arrived at, but maybe some things that can happen on the surface lot that make it feel more inviting, allow it to be more of a partner with some of its neighbors like the Brew Pub. And if that doesn't happen, if it's going to be sold and there's some revenue generated there, then I think we need to actively be engaged with the city as to how those revenues are allocated, and that hopefully we do see some other ways of activating and improving the experience for people in the public spaces that we do have available on the street. And, you know, I think for a long time we've set a design standard that says we want to be durable, we want to be high quality materials, we want to be artful, and maybe we need to look at ways of being more engaging and do things that attract families and allow kids to have some fun while they're waiting for parents that are in a store for a minute or two, and teach people a little bit about our history in an active and engaging way, and just find fun ways to use our public spaces that sort of round out the experience while you're on the street.
And this is all going to happen in the council's budgeting process this spring and early summer. And I'm guessing, I mean, is it the Historic Park City Alliance? I mean, would you lobby then to try and keep it within city ownership? Or
I don't know that that particular property will be the only focus, but we will for sure want to understand if they're going to sell it. Are there some strings attached? Are there some design guidelines? Are there some ways of sort of mixing commercial and public use there that could help achieve some of our goals? And again, more importantly, that we look sort of at the big picture of what funds are being generated from resort sales tax and other mechanisms that were promised and allocated towards making some improvements to this district and adding to our vitality, and that we don't get forgotten in the mix of these big opportunities that we had for open space purchases. And a lot of our membership is you know, lives local and works local, and they understand those kind of rare opportunities, but we don't want to be the forgotten stepchild either.
Okay. We'll bring you back, talk a little more about the summer season, but anything else right now you wanted to mention?
No, just that we're also working on our marketing arm, and had some great successes with our website and social media, and a great feature in Salt Lake Magazine this week that people can check out. In the meantime, we're going to try to work on our maps and make those a little bit easier to access, and people can understand the kinds of variety of price points and offerings that we have there in digital format, and easily access that information. So those are things that people can look for from us this year.
Okay. Any construction happening that you know of?
Fairly limited construction, it sounds like, as we kind of reassess what public improvements need to be made.
Okay. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's 8:34. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as Peace House works to fund its new shelter and campus, the Utah State Legislature this year helped out, kicking in almost $1 million. In the studio with details, I have Peace House's Executive Director, Kendra Wyckoff, along with Capital Campaign Manager, Liza Springmeyer, and Karen Myrett, the chair of the Thrive Foundation here in terms of the raising money specifically for this. Good morning to you all. Ladies.
Good morning.
Thanks,
good
morning.
So, Kendra, how much did you actually get from the state legislature?
Well, we are just really thrilled and excited to share that we earned the support of the Utah State Legislature in the amount of $900,000. And it was just fantastic. We had incredible support from Senator Van Tassel. He was really the spokesperson for the Peace House and for this critical project that we have here in our community. And we're just so incredibly grateful for his championing the project as well as survivors of domestic violence and their families.
So is this the first contribution from the state ever for the Peace House, to the Peace House?
This is the first capital contribution. In years past, as a collective group of domestic violence providers, we have received support from the state legislature to support operations, but this is the first specific request that goes to support the Peace House and our project.
Yeah. Why do you think you got the support for it? I mean, do you have to provide something in return?
Well, absolutely. I think the state legislature, Senator Van Tassel, Senator Christensen, Representative Quinn, were all incredibly supportive. I think that they very much understand the critical need for services for domestic violence survivors in our communities, as well as across the state, that this is a very prevalent issue, one that we can't ignore, that we need to dedicate valuable resources to support the need in our communities. And with our project, we're really addressing the issue and supporting survivors with comprehensive services. And those services include things like transitional housing, which is an incredible barrier for survivors in leaving an abusive relationship when they don't have access to safe and affordable housing.
Yeah. Was that the ask? For 900, or did you ask for more?
Well, we asked for more, actually. So we came to them with our last amount, our gap, a remaining gap, and at the time that was 1.4 million. And we presented them with all of the other support that we had earned before going to them. And I think that was a real help, something to our advantage, that we had already garnished the support of Summit County in partnership with Tanger Outlets, which was the first funding for this project, as well as Park City Municipal has been an outstanding champion for this project with their partnership with Intermountain Healthcare that helped us receive the land, as well as funding to help build our transitional housing. And we received a grant from the Federal Home Loan Bank in the amount of $750,000. All of those public-private partnerships have helped us raise over half of our project funding.
Yeah. So what was the total amount needed then for the project?
So at the time when we presented the case, it was $1.4 million. The total, or our gap, our total project is $11.6
million. Okay. So you're short by how much now of that $11.6 million?
Well, Karen, do you want to address
sure.
the rest
it's your
of
job
the...
then, Karen.
Yeah, I'm the money girl. well, already we've received $5.4 million in private philanthropic support. So individuals in our community, foundations. And so now we're down to, we just last week received another $100,000 from a couple of individuals. And we have some other things in the pipeline, but we're down to $400,000 left of our fundraising to complete the $11.6 million project for the new community campus, which is already underway, which is out right next to the Park City Hospital. Footings have been poured, foundations are being poured. It's perfectly sandwiched between the hospital and People's Health Clinic. And we expect to hopefully be done a year from now. So we are getting really close, and we're trying to close this gap of the $400,000, and we're reaching out to individuals in the community. This is everybody's kind of one-time opportunity to donate to the campus. Every donor will be recognized on a donor wall. We have larger gifts starting between $20,000 and $50,000 for a Thrive Wall, where you can acknowledge somebody that has helped you thrive in your life. Our campaign is called the Thrive Campaign, and that comes out of, you know, we are not here simply to help people survive these experiences of domestic abuse, but we want them to be able to move forward and thrive. And that's what this new campus allows us to do with the transitional housing. We now have 12 transitional housing spaces. We've gone from 5 emergency shelter units to 8 emergency shelter units. One of the big barriers for success for women, we serve men and women and families, but mostly it is women, and they're going back into the workforce and trying to figure out childcare. We'll have a childcare center for those that will be there, and more extended resources and therapies. We've increased our therapies from 1,000 hours to this last year, 2,400 hours of therapy. And so this new facility will give us the space, the time, the resources, the support to really help everybody move forward and thrive, not simply survive.
All right. So really, I mean, Liza, the capital campaign has been pretty quiet. I mean, I haven't heard much about it.
Yeah, so it's a difficult balance because we're still operating, and as we prepare for this transition to go into the new facility, we want to make sure that we are honoring our annual supporters and not taking away from those supporters that help keep our lights on to help us put in new lights for the new facility. So we want to make sure that if someone is giving what they can to Peace House already, that they continue that annual operating support and that they continue. We've got a spring luncheon around the corner. We're still planning to have the Bling Fling in November, and all of these things help us with the support that we're able to provide survivors and their children. But now is our opportunity to come to the community and say, hey, we're close to finishing this project, and if you have extra funds or if you are inspired by this Thrive campaign and want to give something above and beyond what you're already doing, please join us in making this project a reality.
All right. Is the best way to do that just going online?
You can go online or you can call me. my phone number is 435-776-6949. And my email address is liza@peacehouse.org. And I'd love to talk with you about different opportunities. And we do have a donation platform on our website. Just be sure to indicate if you want it to go to annual and or capital, just to help us with navigating that space.
Yeah. And I was going to say, Kendra, this has got to be a little bit concerning. I mean, just the fact that you've gotten bigger, that means it costs more money. I mean, you need more staff, you need, right, more supplies. I mean, everything grows.
Yeah, absolutely, Leslie. I think our board and our organization and team has been very thoughtful about that growth and has been strategic. We have been working to build some capacity. As Karen said earlier, we have been building our therapy and our clinical team, and we'll continue to do that over the next year. We will have the introduction of two new programs, transitional housing as well as the child care center. And so we hope that that will give folks an opportunity, our community that have interest in those specific types of programs, to support survivors, be inspired by those programs, and have the opportunity to support and underwrite some of those programs. So we're working really hard. We're being strategic in those approaches, and we'll continue those fundraising efforts.
So as Karen mentioned, we do have a foundation out there. What's the process, the timeline for actually getting moved in?
Oh, well, for the new campus, we're anticipating that the campus will be completed the first quarter of 2019. So we're hoping in about a year from now. We broke ground September 2017. And as you can imagine, with construction, there's ebb and flow. We've had a few hiccups along the way, big rocks and soil issues, but that meant much of that has been resolved. We're working very closely with New Star Construction. They've been fantastic supporters of Peace House and are doing a wonderful job out at the site. All the foundations have been poured. We're starting to see some vertical growth. We're seeing masonry done, and we'll be seeing framing in the next probably month or so. So we're extremely excited about the progress.
And then you also have some pretty valuable property, given that it's in downtown Park City. I mean, what happens with that?
With the existing facility, that existing facility has already been sold. The city has purchased that facility. They have been incredible supporters of Peace House, and we right now currently are still utilizing that facility until we're able to make that transition to our new campus.
And the existing shelter has always, the location has always been kept. Mom, you've decided not to do that with the new shelter. What's the change in thinking here?
Well, one of the things that we really have done a considerable amount of work around is looking at what other models exist across the nation and in the state here. And those trends are changing. We really want to message to our community that this is an issue that is something that we need to address, that we need to have front and center. We want to have a storefront in our community where we can increase accessibility and visibility around the issue of domestic violence and you know, being sure that people can have access and understand where they can go to receive support. Our hope is that we are seeing more people come to us before crisis so that we can prevent some of the challenges and issues and circumstances that families experience in our community, but that we're there when they're also experiencing those issues as well. And the other message that we feel really strongly about is that we want survivors to know that we're here for them, and we want to reduce the shame and the stigma associated with this issue, bringing, you know, this issue out of the shadows and into the light in our community so that we can continue to work to get upstream and reduce the rates of domestic violence.
Does that increase even more cost, though, for you, having to then now provide somewhat heightened security at the new location?
Well, certainly, you know, any time that you have a larger facility and you have some of those other issues that we have to take into consideration, security is always at the forefront of our mind in this work. And so we'll be working very closely with our construction company and with some of those individuals that are providing support with security so that we're able to design optimal security and dovetail that with policies and protocols that support individual safety and stability.
Okay, anything else anyone wanted to add?
Well, we're just so grateful to be in this place and grateful to our community for the ongoing support that they give Peace House and for helping this Thrive campaign truly thrive. We are so close to the end, and we hope that you'll join us in getting there.
Okay, Kendra, Liza, and Karen, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
8:47 now, good morning. Well, as Park City area residents to continue to support open space purchases, the Utah legislature this session shut off a funding valve that has been used to purchase open space across the state for the last 20 years. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Leslie.
Well, let's just start globally first here. You watched this year as the Lee Ray McAllister Critical Lands Fund was defunded. How come? We had a $600 million budget surplus this year.
Yeah, I mean, it should be astonishing, really, to anybody, Leslie. This is a fund that has, with $22 million over 20 years, leveraged $200 million in land preservation. So it was really unfortunate, and it actually was on the base budget for complete elimination. Representative Duckworth had $1 million request in. I think Representative Handy had a request in to actually keep this funded. But the reality of the situation is we have folks in the leadership who are not interested in seeing land preservation. They do happen to be in the development industry, but I don't really see that being the purpose, because we've had lots of real estate agents and developers over the years who recognize that protecting open space protects quality of life and market values. So, you know, we're not really sure why they didn't make this a priority, because, as you say, there was a surplus, and there could have just been even a small amount of funding that would have helped out a lot of communities that are now looking to preserve open space.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, I mean, could you structure it some way, just like we do with our tourism marketing fund? I mean, there's a kind of a return, and then in a sense, when you can show, you know, 10 times the return on funding, that maybe there's an opportunity for that, or is it just a lost cause?
You know, we've had a lot of conversations with other legislators who are interested in, you know, seeing if there can be something that is done. And I don't know if it's going to come back in the form of the Lee Ray McAllister Fund itself. A lot of people no longer know who Senator Lee Ray McAllister was. So it may be that we have to come up with some other different form. But the good news, from my perspective, is a lot of the people that were against this funding and against open space in the legislature are leaving the legislature. So there are 26 new seats, House and Senate, that are up for election this year. And, you know, hopefully we get some good leaders in there who recognize exactly what you are saying, Leslie, which is this is our economic bottom line. The top two reasons people come to Utah for business, to move here, to visit, are its scenic beauty and recreational opportunity. And that's been that way for 27 years. So if we don't protect that, we're actually really hurting our economic bottom line. And places like Park City understand that, but there are communities throughout the state of Utah that recognize that protecting our quality of life is really makes economic sense.
Yeah, and I guess it's not an uphill battle, though, because there was certainly a lot of support in the state for the cutting back of the two national monuments that we saw earlier in the year.
Well, exactly, Leslie. I mean, you know, if you look at it, you have some folks that were in the legislature, people like Representative Noel, who is leaving the legislature. He went after a number of things. He went after Salt Lake City's extraterritorial jurisdiction to preserve the watershed that protects, you know, the drinking water for the entire Salt Lake Valley. I mean, you know, just really some thoughtless and really lack of leadership is what I think we witnessed. And certainly with the national monuments, there's a lot of support for our national monuments, but they went after those as well. So, you know, again, it takes good leadership, and we're hoping that can come from people who are running for those positions in the upcoming election. But really, I think the other thing that we're looking at is if you care about open space, if you care about these things that really are drivers of our economy, the best thing you can do is call your representative because they do listen. And we actually found that the more people that called and wrote individual emails, so, you know, don't just click on a button and send a form email, but actually call them up, make a relationship with these people, let them know what you care about. They're your elected leaders. And even if they're not your particular district, you know, we all go visit different places in the state of Utah, and I think it's important for them to know that we care about our open spaces and that this is part of our economic future and sustainability as a state.
Let's move on to another issue. The Snow Ranch Pastures, this flyer came in the mail this week, and I'm not sure how widespread that is, but tell us a little bit about Snow Ranch Pastures. Where is this located?
Well, these are the pastures that are located at the corner of Three Kings Drive and Thanes Canyon Drive. And it's about 19 acres. It's really quite visible from a number of areas. It's visible from the Armstrong Trail that many people are familiar with. And we have talked with this family for a long time. And we're now wanting to know if this is something the community would support in terms of its preservation. We think it's a tremendous opportunity. It's one of the last undeveloped heirloom areas, you know, agricultural landscapes that is in Park City city limits.
So is this the Armstrong family or a different property owner?
This is the Armstrong family. It's two different sides of the Armstrong family that own the pastures. And, you know, fortunately, they are committed to conservation as well. You know, there are, as you might imagine with families, you have people that you pass land on to, that sort of thing. But the Armstrongs, both sides of the family, are interested in coming to a conservation solution. They can't donate the entire value. But we think if this is something that people indicate that they're interested in seeing protected, we can come to a really great conservation easement solution for this property.
So it is not zoned agriculture, huh? It's zoned as residential?
No. No, that was kind of a surprise to us. It's actually, the current zoning on it is a third-acre development.
Okay. And so what you're just trying to get a sense from people, whether or not this is something worth pursuing?
Yeah, what we're trying to really understand from the community, you know, Utah Open Lands, as you know, works on a lot of projects to do the fundraising and to permanently protect properties. And what we're really looking at in this particular instance is their support. If we're going to go to various different funders, it's really critical to have community support. We've known this forever, really, as an organization for the 27 years that we've been working on land preservation. And what we have found is if we can go to donors and foundations, and even agencies, and ask for funding, if we can show a really strong demonstration of support from the community, that makes a huge difference. it enables us to say, look, you know, we have this many people that are interested in seeing the land protected. We even saw that with Bonanza Flat. The more that the community got engaged, the more that we had donors and others who were willing to come to the table. And I think also it's a tremendous element to be able to talk to the landowners themselves about. As much as landowners care about this particular piece of property, you know, we're hoping that the community can say, yes, we'd like to see this property protected as well. And certainly any donors who are interested in participating, we'd love to hear from them as well.
So how much do we need to raise?
Well, at this point, those negotiations, we haven't moved forward on the actual price. We did get an initial appraisal of the property, and the conservation easement appraisal came out at $16 million. We have talked with the family and said there's just no way that we as an organization feel we could raise that much money. And they've indicated that they would be willing to make a substantial contribution. But we're just at the beginning of those conversations.
Okay. Otherwise, it is currently zoned for 57 home sites.
I think it's less than, I'd have to go back and look at the, I think it's like 40.
Okay. 40. I just did 19 times 3, so I didn't, yeah. Okay. Finally wanted to talk to you about Bonanza Flat. You made some, you presented to the Park City Council recently, and I'm just wondering now, is this your final recommendation, or is this just kind of a draft and that we go from here now based on some back and forth with the community?
Yeah, it is just a draft at this point, and all along we have felt, and I believe the City Council has felt, that it is critical to have public input throughout this entire process. And as we talked with the technical committee and the jurisdictional stakeholders at our last round when we had completed most of the resource inventory, you know, there were a lot of questions about some of the different uses. So we didn't hit all of the uses, but I guess I would say, Leslie, we hit kind of the hot topic issues. Motorized recreational use on the property. We're recommending that motorized recreational use be prohibited. We think there still should be travel corridors that go through the property to adjacent motorized recreational uses and adjacent properties. But we think that that should be prohibited based on what we've seen. And, you know, we are recommending against ski lifts and ski towers going across the property. And then we're also recommending that hunting would have to be through something that would be really akin to a management tool that would be essentially prohibited. It's not an area that we have seen a ton of hunting in, and talking with a lot of folks that have been up there for years and years, they've actually really discouraged, as has the private landowner previously, discouraged hunting. So we knew those would be hot-button issues, and we brought them up, and now there's the opportunity for a lot of different entities to weigh in. We had the jurisdictional and technical committee meetings on Friday, just this last Friday, and there was a lot of discussion about all of these issues. We also have a public open house April 2nd, so that's this coming Monday, not this Monday, but the following Monday, from 4:30 to 6:30 in the council chambers. We'll have folks from Park City and Utah Open Lands on hand to talk about the recommendations, to guide people through what we're looking at. Certainly our recommendations didn't include everything that we're going to be recommending at the end of the day. A lot of those are no-brainers, like no mining on the property, no development on the property. But we did feel like it was important to hit some of the high issues that we know might be a little bit more debate.
Okay. Again, if people do have something to say, April 2nd would probably be a big good time to do that, huh?
Absolutely. Okay. They can also email Utah Open Lands, info@utahopenlands.org, with any questions. We will actually have some things, some surveys for people to be able to fill out April 2nd, and we'll make sure that those are available on Park City's website and on Utah Open Lands website for people to comment as well. We want to hear what the public has to say.
Okay. Wendy, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.